And tonight with our guest, Jonathan Zapp, we talk about, of course, the psychopath through singularity archetypes. We'll talk more about that when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Jonathan Zapp with us as well. Jonathan, so far it seems like these psychopaths, the singularity archetype, that they seem to be very successful at what they do. Is that pretty accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, they're both successful genetically in that they spread their genes more, but they also they were always adapted to power hierarchies, but they're the present setup where people can move in their careers and always be in a new group of strangers. So before they get found out, they're off to a different corporation and so forth. It's really perfect for psychopaths. And we kind of missed the punchline last segment. I was talking about the 1% and the 99%, and we were talking about how, you know, it's really not 1%. It's way less than that. But what is 1% and 99% is it just so happens that the psychopaths are 1%. So the whole 1%, 99%, theme that we've been hearing and it's been playing out in the culture, I think is really part of the awakening that, wow, we live with a subspecies, and that subspecies tends to, like, get all the power and run our lives, and we want to do something about it. So what the singularity archetype shows is that things that look very dark may actually be more like the darkness before the dawn. It shows us that, like, the very things that seem like they're about to clobber us may be the same things that stimulate the metamorphosis. And I can give you an example of this and a classic example of the singularity archetype in two very quick dreams that'll illustrate this paradox. So these were dreams recorded by one of Jung's colleagues. And in the first dream, what we see, the dreamer, who's described as a very simple Christian woman, she has this terrifying dream where the dark wing of Satan comes down and touches the earth at the Middle East, and she's terrified, and she's standing on the earth, and it seems like, you know, Armageddon. But in her next dream, she sees the same event, but now she's up in the heavens, and what looked like the wing of Satan now is revealed to be the white wafting cloak of God. She draws a white spiral of light in the sky. The spiral is a symbol of the singularity archetype. It seems to be drawing the viewer into another dimension. It looks like a portal, and the figure of Jesus is there, reaching his hand out toward man as if inviting him to, like, step through the portal. So what we see in these two dreams is that what looked like Armageddon and looked like the worst thing in the world when you're standing on the ground, when you're in the ego point of view, when you are above, it is seen as the same event as a transcendent evolutionary event. So this is exactly what happens in an NDE. Somebody is having a heart attack, they are having what seems like the worst thing in the world, but then they leave their body and suddenly they realize that, like, this shock to their system is going to transform them spiritually. And this is how it can work biologically, like with psychopaths, just like predators and parasites are a key part of living systems. Like, British biologists came up with something they call the Red Queen hypothesis. It comes from Alice in Wonderland, where the Red Queen says to Alice, you know, you see here, my dear, you have to run as fast as you can just to keep up. And what these biologists say is that the sexual differentiation as compared to asexual reproduction in more primitive organisms, came into being because of parasites. That parasites, which outnumber other species 4 or 5 to 1, and psychopaths are actually considered closer to parasites than predators. They prefer to live off of you than to kill you most of the time. Actually spurred the development of sex, because in order for organisms to keep up with parasites, they had to have the greater genetic novelty of sexual reproduction as compared to asexual. So in other words, psychopaths can, and other certain dark, challenging things, can be what spurs evolution on. Because if you don't have these antagonists, you don't get evolution. So for example, if I made you God, George, and I said, create a story where there's going to be a person who's going to develop spiritually, you're not going to give them the perfect girlfriend and perfect economy and perfect relationships and so forth, that you have the world's most boring story and it'll never develop. You're going to have to create evil. You're going to have to create an antagonist. Just like, for example, in Lord of the Rings, which is a story about a turning of ages. It's where a whole new age, a whole new cycle is going to begin. If you took out the orcs and Sauron and Saruman and so forth, you'd have hobbits going out on dates with other hobbits. You know, they'd be very contented, but nothing would happen, and you wouldn't get a cycling of ages. To get that, you need these great evil figures to come in and challenge everything and get the system moving. So we can find out that as bad as psychopaths are, and indeed we should become more aware of them and do something about them, that in awakening to them, we may actually transform ourselves and discover that through that evolutionary pressure, that contributed to the metamorphosis.
Well, it seems though, Jonathan, though, that these psychopaths, and we seem to be keen in on them right now, and we'll get into some other areas, but how can the good people, you know, the people who care about this planet and care about other things, how can they defeat those psychopaths? They just seem too overwhelming.
Well, in the one way that that happens in the singularity archetype is, you talked about the Theodore Sturgeon novel More Than Human, is that the other type of folks who may also be mutants, they may form a telepathic network. Now, this is actually happening on a technological level. It's called the intranet. So now there's been an explosion, and your show is part of this, George. It's kind of like a beacon in the night. It's giving out all that information that would otherwise people would not be aware of and not able to wake up. So what you're doing is part of this networked consciousness, because through technology, instead of being like a serf on one lord's manor, and you don't even know what the other serfs are doing, you know, but they're suffering in the same way you are, now we have all the individuals who are part of the 99% have access to tremendous information. We have the technological equivalent of that telepathic network. Now, it may also be that when we if we break into that in a more organic sense, where the more caring people are able to form a more common consciousness, some kind of organic version of that telepathic network, and we see that happen in individual cases, but we haven't seen it on a large scale, then that starts to create a powerful new species that can overthrow the power of psychopaths. Psychopaths depend on deception, just like psychopathic governments depend on deception and depend on controlling the information. But let's say we have, through organic evolution, suddenly a whole bunch of people start to excel in remote viewing, and now they can pierce the secret vaults and see what the governments are hiding and see who's a psychopath and put that up on websites so that other people know. Now the whole system can have an immunological response to this other competing species, subspecies, and that can contribute to the metamorphosis. So when you have a challenge to survival, and especially if that challenge challenges the whole genome, because it really could be come down to one psychopath with their finger on the wrong button, or they're having the vial of genetically engineered virus in their hand, that could wreck everything. And so to deal with that threat, the rest of us have to sort of up our evolutionary game. That's the whole Red Queen hypothesis. We have to run faster, and we have to change faster to keep ahead of the psychopaths and their tricks. And I think that Coast to Coast, and I think lots of websites and people are doing that very thing. And we're onto it. We're starting to get the joke. And the joke has been going on for a very long time, and we're waking up. So I think there's this metamorphosis is beginning in certain ways.
Well, we're trying. There's no doubt about that. So as you look at these singularity archetypes, what other areas did you research, Jonathan, beyond the psychopath?
Well, one of the very interesting areas is near-death experience research, because another way that people encounter the singularity archetype is when it shows up at the edge, when they cross past the edge of ordinary life and their heart stops beating, and now they will actually have many of the things that in sci-fi fantasies are predicted to happen for the future of the species actually happen to to them. So people will very commonly report, as often happens with UFO abduction cases, that beings are coming forward and communicating to them telepathically. Like one kid who had a near-death experience was on a documentary, and he's telling his dad, when he said that a voice spoke to him, he said, not like this, and he taps his mouth, but like this, and he taps his head. So this is very common, and people also have an enhanced vision. People who were even blind since birth may have visually comprehended experiences. Dr. Kenneth Ring wrote a book about this called Mindsight. People who had maybe very myopic vision may have 360-degree or even spherical vision, and with infinite depth of field. So they get all these sort of paranormal enhancements. And one place where you see both of these streams, the futuristic and the future of the species and the near-death experience, intersect perfectly is in the classic movie, I don't know if you've ever seen it, 2001, the Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke
masterpiece. Yeah, of course. It was one of the best ever.
Absolutely. And a lot of people have puzzled about it. But one of the interesting things about 2001, it's one of the classic examples of the near-death experience, I mean, of the singularity archetype, is the incredible parallels to near-death experience. And remember that this came out in 1968, and it wasn't until 1975 that Raymond Moody wrote his book, Life After Life, and suddenly we all became aware of things like life review. And that kind of thing that we were completely unaware of.
I was just with Raymond a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact. He's still going strong.
Well, he's an amazing guy, and it's also amazing that he's a professor of logic and Greek philosophy, so
he really loves it.
Understands, on the deepest level what this phenomenon means. So in 2001, when Bowman, who's the astronaut, is going through what's called a Stargate. 2001 is one of the first mentions in the English language of this word, Stargate. And when he starts...
Now, I need you to talk into your phone, John.
Okay. When he starts going through it, he starts to have a life review. Now, remember that, like, the near-death experience, life review, these were phrases that were not even in the language at that point. And yet they're described in my book. There I put side by side the description of him having the life review as he goes through the Stargate, and near-death experiencers describing their life review, and it's almost the same description. And he also goes through a tunnel of light, if you remember, very much like what near-death experiencers do. So you see this turning up in many different places. The same kind of themes play out in actual experiences that people have when they have near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, sometimes in dreams, and also as they appear in science fiction fantasies and in other projections about what's going to happen in the future. However, no dates are assigned, because as you probably know from some of our other shows, I'm kind of a critic of apocalypticism and have a psychological interpretation of why people go apocalyptic with it. That's kind of the dark side of the singularity archetype, is people become possessed by it and they get these apocalyptic visions with certain dates attached and so forth. That's an example of the singularity archetype pathologizing and possessing people. And they don't see that it's actually something that's almost impossible to predict, and that it's something that you have to be careful about judging as dark, because the very thing that seems like it's destroying you or the species can be the very thing that transforms it.
All right, as you got into this, did you find anything startling, shocking?
Yeah, I mean, the whole experience began for me with a series of shocks. And some of them, like I'll give you an example of one. When I was about 13 years old, I was just sitting with my dad during the day, and we happened to watch a sci-fi movie. I'd seen a million of those. It was a movie called, it was a 1960 British film called Village of the Damned.
Oh, yes. Remember
and
that.
And classic, right? And you know, there are these children who are born as a result of, like, UFOs appearing over certain areas, and they're mutants, and they have eyes that glow. They form a telepathic network, a homo gestalt, you know, many of these classic things. It's seen through the fearful eyes of the ego, this particular version of it, of the singularity archetype. And when I saw this movie, I was completely shocked. I knew that it was something, had something of the deepest significance in it, but I had no idea why. I'd seen many other science fiction movies, and I'm just watching a little TV screen. Why was it so powerful? It wasn't until my last year in college, when I was 20 years old, and I set out to find out, that it began to make sense. And it was actually my mom who said, well, you know, you should look into this. She was a psychologist for 44 years. She said, you should look into this guy, Carl Jung, and his theory of the archetypes and the collective unconscious. So I go up to the library. I'm standing in front of the beautiful black Bowling and Princeton edition of Jung's collected works, but I'm sort of skeptical of, like, okay, you know, my mom told me to do it, but, like, what's this dead Swiss guy born in the 19th century going to tell me about my weird sci-fi obsessions? But I look in the index volume, I see, wow, he wrote a book called Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. Well, that's a direct hit, because that has everything to do with this. I go right to that book. He wrote it just a few years before he died, and I'm flipping through it, and I see that at the end of the book, there's like an epilogue, then there's like a second epilogue, and then there's like a supplement. It's like he couldn't let go of the subject. Well, the supplement was his analysis of a British science fiction novel called The Midwich Cuckoos. Well, that is the novel that the movie Village of the Damned was based on. So my first encounter with Jung, it was almost as if he were a holographic wizard stepping out of the bookcase, bearing a torch and saying, like, yeah, I was wondering about that one too. Here's what I thought. So I was able to stand on the shoulders of this giant with the theories that he developed that would allow me to understand why a cultural artifact like a movie could be a haunting shock and so forth, because it contained this powerful archetype. But I was able to pick up where he left off, because he was just beginning to look into this, and he only had a couple more years to live and didn't get to see the 53 more years of the phenomenon that I've been able to see. And so it was a shock like that got me going. It was also some of my own paranormal experiences that made me aware that there's something more to what's going on than what I'm being told in school and in the mass media. And so that's probably relates to your path and to many of the listeners who've had these kind of strange rupture of plane experiences that tell them, you know what, there's something more here than what I'm being told and what the culture is representing. And there is some kind of path of metamorphosis that's available to us. And the singularity archetype is sort of this classic pattern that shows us how that metamorphosis can occur and does occur.
And when you looked at all of this, I want to get into near-death experiences with you after the break, but real quickly, how did the UFOs and the UFO subject matter fit into all of this?
Well, it's another gigantic subject, and Jung, who gave it a psychological interpretation, also noted that they reflected radar. He knew that there was a real physical phenomenon, and so you can have a real physical phenomenon that human beings project psychological and archetypal things onto, but you also seem to have with ufology a shape-shifting phenomenon that itself has many aspects of the singularity archetype, like homo gestalt, the gray aliens with their large eyes, and because a big part of this is visual telepathy, and the gray aliens, for example, speak to people telepathically. They also seem to be a homo gestalt. They're often described as having a hive mind. And they frequently show people visions of the destruction of the earth and tell them you have to change and so forth. So there's all kinds of ways that it relates.
Jonathan, when we come back, let's talk about near-death experiences as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, never, ever, ever feel left out. Wherever you may go, you're always connected to this program. Download the iHeart app. It's just that simple. iHeart Radio app. It's in the stores. Or you can go to iHeartRadio.com. No matter where you go, pick it up, listen to your favorite station, And there you are. Simple as that. Welcome back. Jonathan Zapp with us. Jonathan, near-death experiences. Touched on it a little bit with Raymond Moody, but tie this into the singularity archetype that you've researched.
Okay. So with the near-death experience, people actually cross the event horizon, and all these things in the futuristic fantasies are sort of prophesied or predicted for the future of the species actually happen. So, for example, in the best studies we have of near-death experiences, and the very best were done in several Dutch hospitals, and Dr. Pim van Lommel was kind of conducted those and had them published in a prestigious medical journal, Lancet. So these are pretty solid results. One of the most common findings is people report an increase in paranormal phenomenon and various paranormal abilities. So some of it is inconvenient, like they're more likely to disrupt appliances, especially computers. But people actually have paranormal experiences during the near-death experiences where their eyes may be taped shut, or like in the Pam Reynolds case where, you know, she has like 38 people working on her, and she has absolutely no electrical activity in her brain. People can read a more detailed version of it in my book. But, I mean, this is a woman who had no blood in her brain because she was having a very exotic operation called standstill going on. And despite all these factors, she's able to see things, including exotic equipment like the Midas Rex bone saw in the room, and able to say it looks more like an electric toothbrush. She's able to hear things that people said when she had no electrical activity in her brain. She had two EKG systems set up to test for that, and she had 100 decibel clicking sounds happening in her ears with earbuds, and yet she's still able to come back and report what people said during that experience. Sometimes people have been able to sort of have remote viewing and see objects on top of the hospital roof when they're having an out-of-body experience during the NDE. They transcend linear time, just like that character Paul Muad'Dib does in the Dune books, and where he gains this prescience. People step out of linear time where they can have a comprehensive life review. That's one of the most classic parts. But sometimes they have a flash forward and see images from the future that later prove out. So that's another aspect, is that they are able to transcend their place in linear time. They're able to transcend their ego, and they achieve a greater unity consciousness. And that's described in a lot of the best studies, that people feel more connected to other people, more empathic. And another thing that indicates that the near-death experience is not so much an experience, because the power of any experience will tend to fade a bit with time. When they tested these people and surveyed them 7 years later, the power of the experience had only increased. That suggests an archetype. It suggests that there is this living agency inside of them that's only furthering the metamorphosis and the transformation as they age. And so NDEs are not only an example of actually crossing the event horizon and going through all these aspects of the singularity archetype, but they may themselves be an incredible evolutionary catalyst. And realize that something about NDEs has changed radically since Raymond Moody wrote his book in 1975. Not only have we become far more aware of them, but their number has increased tremendously due to resuscitation technology. Even in just the last 2 or 3 years, they've had radical advances in resuscitation technology. I think people on your show have talked about it, where they're able to bring back people who've been gone for a couple of hours if they were at a low temperature. And we're really like pushing past the old definitions of death. And so now we're having a much higher percentage of the population. We're coming back and having far more profound NDEs because they were under for lengths of time that in the past we never could have brought somebody back. So even in the 80s, Dr. Kenneth Ring speculated that NDEs could be an evolutionary catalyst. And as we have a higher percentage of the population who are actually online with the positive side of the singularity archetype.
Now, when you were doing all this work, did it come easy for you? Or was it difficult? Because it's, you know, it's not an easy subject.
Well, it's not. But because archetypes have so much energy, and because the singularity archetype has so many points of connection with what's going on, it's a subject, you know, working on anything has its hard aspects here and there, because it's not somebody, it's not a good job description, for example, to say I want to study the singularity archetype. So you don't easily make a living at it. On the other hand, synchronicities, dreams, it's sort of been a thematic unity in my whole life, because once you start working on it and start paying attention to it, because it's a living agency, it sort of pays attention to you and starts showing you all kinds of different things. And right now, I'm in a very exciting phase of the work, because when I first wrote a philosophy honors paper, this is when I made the discovery when I was 20 in 1978, it was called Archetypes of a New Evolution. And after I wrote that, I realized that I also really wanted to explore it on the imaginal plane. I wanted to write a fantasy fiction epic and go into it from that aspect as more of an experiencer than an analyst. And that's what I've been working on recently. I've tried many times in the past on a fantasy epic called Parallel Journeys, but in the last year, I've really been able to get in the zone and get up at 2:30 and 3 a.m. It'll wake me up even if I didn't go to sleep early enough, so I can get a big sleep deficit. But I can feel something waking me up at that hour to write fantasy fiction about it and to see how it unfolds in my imagination. So that's a way in which it has been easy, in that it gives energy, and it provides opportunities, and it provides new phenomena all the time to show itself to somebody who really wants to pay attention. And so that's why it would be good for people to read about the singularity archetype, because it activates it within them. And in a parallel way, it's been shown by Dr. Kenneth Ring and others that NDEs are like a benign virus, that many of the transformative effect of NDEs, just reading about NDEs, will actually create a parallel version of those transformative effects in people. So it's very important that people read about NDEs, look at videos of some people who've had that experience, and also, I'll make a plug for my book, read about the singularity archetype and see some of the examples that are too detailed to go into tonight, because it can activate the singularity archetype inside of you. And if I can make one more plug on my website, and it's linked up on Coast
to
Coast.
Oh, go ahead.
There's a special for Coast listeners, because you can get the book on Amazon for $11.66, I think is the odd price they came up with. But for $10.95, you can get both a full-color PDF version and the audiobook. And so that's a special for Coast listeners. And I think it's very important that people expose themselves to some of the visions of the singularity archetypes. Arnold Toynbee, the great British historian who mapped the life cycle of civilizations. He wanted to see what made civilizations decline. And what he discovered was the key thing that made a civilization decline is when they no longer had a ruling myth. And so we have lost a lot of those ruling myths. The great religions that were the ruling myth for quite a long time are doubted by many people and don't function very well for a lot of people. In this country, for example, one of the ruling myths was the American dream, but that's being severely challenged right now when we're seeing widening wealth inequality and the idea that you can, like, you know, play fair and just work hard and have like a great upper middle class life. You know, that doesn't seem like it's working so well for people. So the singularity archetype is a new myth, and people have described stories as equipment for living. You know, some people think of myths as like some fanciful thing, or they think myth is the same as a lie. No, it's actually a blueprint for living. It's something that when you tap into the positive side of archetypes, because that's what comes through myths, it actually is life-changing and gives you a way of approaching life where you are transforming and metamorphosing and are moving toward the event horizon that we all have to face, whether the end of the species comes in our lifetime or not. We are all hurtling toward that event horizon called death, and the singularity archetype, just like the lessons that people learn from their near-death experiences, teach us how to be ready for that event horizon. And so it's extremely valuable that people expose themselves to that kind of material.
What is stronger, the dark side or the bright side of this?
Well, I think I would have to say the bright side, and I'll tell you why. But we don't want to be too glib, because in any particular case, you know, the life cycle of the species and the life cycle of the individual parallel. And so there could be many possible outcomes for the species as there are for the individual. Many individuals seem to positively transform, but many others don't, at least if we're looking at one incarnation. So we don't want to presume that without our diligent efforts that the light wins out over the dark in every situation. There does seem to be a force in the universe that is moving us toward greater self-awareness and greater novelty. Now, many evolutionary theorists will have a fit because they see evolution as directionless, as trendlessly fluctuating, as kind of like a drunk just staggering down the street, bouncing off of this, that, and the other thing. Darwin himself, however, spoke highly of teleology, which is the belief that evolution can have a goal. And when we look at how things have unfolded on this planet, we see that it is moving toward greater variety of form, greater novelty, and greater interconnectedness. Look at technological evolution and the internet. So I believe that the forces are prejudiced and spring-loaded toward our achieving an evolutionary metamorphosis, and that many of the things that look extremely dark and are dark from a limited point of view, even things like environmental destruction, what the singularity archetype seems to say is that we may need things that threaten the whole genome in order to get enough transformational pressure for the species to accept the quantum evolutionary change. And this is the way it works out in individual lives. For example, tribal cultures will have rites of initiation, and some of them are so perilous that many people die. You know, there's one culture that they use venomous wasp stings. They have them climb trees and then endure venomous wasp stings. Some fall to their death or take ordeal poisons and so forth. But what happens for people who survive these rites of initiation is that they're transformed. So in other words, in the life of the individual, it is often a life-threatening event that threatens your whole survival that creates the transformation, like a near-death experience.
Is the transformation a positive thing or a negative thing?
Well, in many cases, I would say with near-death experiences, for example, it tends to be a positive thing. But transformations, or let's put it this way, when a shock hits a system, it'll tend to bifurcate. It can go higher or lower. So in other words, you can have a shock that hits a culture and creates a positive revolutionary transformation and people wake up and so forth. But you can have the shock hit another culture and it just sort of deteriorates and you know, you end up with one of those dystopian sci-fi scenarios like Road Warrior, where you have basically things reduced to a much more savage, nomadic level of functioning. Just like with an individual, two individuals have car accidents. One of them suddenly wakes up from their egocentric consciousness and realizes what's really valuable in life, and they become more loving and so forth, and they're positively transformed. The other person feels like, oh, I'm a victim. You know, only bad things happen to me, and they just start drinking more, and they go into a downward spiral. So when the shock hits the system, the transformation could be higher or lower, but I'm putting my money on higher.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens with people when we really start going through some incredible events. And I don't know, will they be ready for these events?
Well, I think that's a question that each of us has to answer, because obviously some people will not be ready, and shocks will only make them spiral out of control, because they're kind of rigid, fragile people who, you know, when when the system doesn't work the way they're accustomed to, and their lights are not coming on, and they're not finding the supermarket open, or whatever the changes might be. It might be something, it doesn't have to be a breakdown of society. It could be that suddenly we have some new virtual reality technology that's really changing people's consciousness. The shock could be a positive thing in a lot of ways. And some people will be ready for that, and some won't. And however, what creates change is not usually a majority. It's usually a very small group. A lot of the greatest changes that have happened, and positive changes, have happened because of a very small group of people that wake up. And they can shift the whole collective psyche, because it's not one man, one psychic vote. You have more votes, you have more effect on the collective if you're higher energy and if you're more unique. So one highly unique mutant can shift everything and be more powerful than a zillion other people who are all kind of the same and all caught in the same rut. But I want to help people get ready, and one of the ways to do that is to understand the singularity archetype, to understand this deep, deep pattern that governs our metamorphosis. And if you can expose yourself to some of the best visions of it, you start to activate it within you, and now you're on the positive side of that transformation. And so I'm very hopeful that that can work.
All right, Jonathan, we're going to hit the break in a few minutes and come back and take phone calls with you here. Of all the things that you've looked at, psychopaths, telepathy, you name it, when it comes to the singularity, which do you think fits it the most? Or is it all?
Well, I mean, all of it is part of the pattern. When you can never quite look at an archetype absolutely clear-cut, because it is such a multifaceted thing. So it's almost as if you're looking at a vision through a round, brilliant diamond, where whatever facet you look through, you're getting different prismatic reflections, almost like a series of cubistic paintings. So you see all these variations. But the Jungian method is you look at many, many different examples, strip away individual peculiar things, idiosyncrasies that only one version has, and then you sort of improve the signal-to-noise ratio and see what they all have in common. And so what you start to see is that whether it's a near-death experience or certain UFO experiences, certain experiences that people have with ayahuasca or LSD or whatever, that they're hitting the same points. They're hitting that breakdown of the ego, transcending linear time, telepathy, more visual communication and consciousness. And so you start to see that whatever part of the phenomenon you look at, like looking at a hologram or a fractal, if you look into it, you see all the parts activated. So no matter what part of it you pick, even the psychopaths, if you look into it deeply, you start to see how it connects to all these other parts of it.
All right, well, we'll connect with you in just a moment, Jonathan, and we'll take phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. And speaking of connecting, of course, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up. Just go up to the far right-hand corner of coasttocoastam.com. Also, follow me on my calendar. More schedules, more events coming up all around the country. And you can just track and find out where I'm going simply by going to coasttocoastam.com. Clicking the calendar section. We will be back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM.